From KCUR News, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Author Daniel Woodrell is best known for his novel Winter's Bone. He's here today with the book doctors to talk about his latest book, A Maid's Version. It's the story of one woman's investigation of her sister's possible murder in a dance hall explosion. Then, if you're wondering what's the latest on the titles currently offered, the book doctors give us their reviews of what's on bookstore shelves. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news.
This is KCUR-FM, KCUR-HD1, Kansas City Public Media.
Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The book doctors are in the house today to talk about some exciting things they've been reading. And today we have a special honorary book doctor with us. Daniel Woodrell is here. He wrote Winter's Bone and the book Woe to Live On that became the Ang Lee film Ride with the Devil. He's won many honors, but honorary book doctor here on Up to Date will be one he cherishes most. Daniel Woodrell speaks tonight in town. Welcome. So good to have you back again, Daniel.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
The book doctors today are Steve Paul. He's a book editor for The Star, who wrote a long piece on Daniel Woodrell's new book, The Maid's Version, in Sunday's paper. He called the book a Missouri classic and said Woodrell can take you into worlds and lives you barely experience otherwise. Steve, always good to have you, too.
Thanks, Steve. Always good to be here.
Also here is Grace Suh. She's a freelance writer and editor. Grace, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
And Mark Luce with the Barstow School will be joining us here in just a few minutes. Well, Daniel, like many good books, this one is based on an experience from your own life. Your grandmother told a story about a dance hall explosion in southern Missouri. What did your grandmother tell you so long ago?
Well, the actual event happened in 1928, and they had a memorial for the dead just this past April again, the 85th anniversary. So it's lingered in the mind the way mysteries do, because it was never satisfactorily solved to the opinions of all. So
just like the version in the maid's story here.
And so that gave it extra life and traction. And as far as the town goes, it never really goes away. But it was a taboo topic until not too long ago. You really bad form to bring it up in public, because you never knew if you were speaking in front of relatives of some of the dead. Or
how many folks died in that
I
incident?
Think it was around 40 that actually died, but there were quite a few burned and maimed and otherwise traumatized.
And the cause of that explosion was what?
They never could come to a convincing conclusion. There was a citizen's inquiry for a while, but for some reason it was disbanded before reaching any conclusions.
Well, the maid of this story is Alma DeGeer Donahue, if I'm saying that right, who tells her grandson about the Arbor Dance Hall explosion in the Missouri Ozarks, and 42 dancers perish in an instant. This story sticks with Alma for a whole host of reasons. Tell us why.
Primarily, she loses her sister in the explosion, but also because of some of her suspicions about what might have led to the explosion kind of fester and grow within her, and not completely without foundation, but she's more dedicated to that explanation than others are.
And she really goes after this thing, too. She just can't let it go for obvious reasons, I guess, you know. To what extent does she go after the truth here, or what she thinks was the truth?
She keeps trying to stir the pot and get people interested in it, but it's one of those things where my own opinion of the actual event was that I had a relative by marriage who was on the Citizens Commission. I didn't know him. He was too old for me, but they were getting somewhere.
Yeah.
And didn't like the direction it was going in, and I'm not sure what that direction was, because all he would ever say was it wasn't accidental, and he would say no more.
Yeah.
And so I don't really know what direction it was going in, but whichever direction it was, it made the leaders of the commission uncomfortable, and they just quietly disbanded it. So there's never really been – there are all kinds of explanations from total accident to various potential human involvements, but that's part of what makes it so fascinating is you can – come up with your own answer, and it might be just as good as
anybody else's.
Right. And is that kind of what you did in this book, was to come up with your answer, not to give anything away whatsoever, but it seems like the sort of play between real history and imagined history is one of the things that really makes this novel.
Well, that's I couldn't get a grip on the book until I decided just the maid's version, just say what the maid thinks happened, in essence. He adds his own interpretations of certain events that he couldn't have known about in detail. But he primarily just, this is what the maid thinks happened. Now, that doesn't give it necessarily more weight than anyone else's opinion, but this was hers, and that's the one that I was most compelled by.
Originally, Daniel, was the original arc of the story going to be broader than just the maid's version? Is that something, and how long did you struggle with sort of stripping down the rest and just going with Alma's story?
The first attempts, I was trying to cover every base. I was trying to give everybody, every potential thread, I was trying to give them almost equal space, and it just didn't gain momentum to me. It seemed to go loose. It was just a little bit too democratic in its approach, and I put it away and thought I wasn't going to go back to it until some months later. All of a sudden, I realized, just tell the version you're most interested in. Just go back to that one version. And
you know, sometimes doing this show is such a kick, Grace. We're sitting here, we're talking to Daniel Woodrell. How cool is that? How cool is that after all these great books, and have such great admiration for your work and what you've done? It's just great to have you here. And Grace, go ahead. You have something you want to ask Daniel?
Tell me about putting this book away for several months.
This is not unusual for me. Most of them go through a phase of from a few weeks to maybe a few months. When you have all that material, and I had a lot of pages written, and it took quite a while to kind of forget about trying to justify the pages you'd already written, which is often a mistake that even at this stage I still sometimes make. I don't want to throw away 180 pages, so I've got to find a way to make them relevant, and eventually you just have to throw them away.
Yeah, how hard is that for a writer? Because all of us who have struggled with this stuff for so long, you realize, you know, that invariably, so often it seems, the answer is chopping stuff away, throwing it out the window, and suddenly things seem a little clearer.
It's depressing to realize you just spent 14 months in the wrong direction, but it's necessary to do it. And the more you do it, I hope the more quickly you'll recognize what has to be done and do it. I had earlier books where I went on and on and on trying to make the original conception of it work when it was becoming clear that wasn't going to get you where you were trying to go, and you were going to have to back up and put a new start.
Some people refer to this as killing your babies.
That's right. Was it your decision to go ahead and toss it out, or did you have an editor or your spouse sort of breathing down your neck saying, Daniel, this isn't working?
No, my editor doesn't usually jump in until the end. She may see a portion of the novel before then, but if I'm think I'm getting somewhere, she's usually let you go ahead and see if you're going to get there. But when I read aloud almost every day when I get done, and I could tell it wasn't quite gelling to the extent that I like them to. And
because you do have that sense after you've been doing this for a while, it's like, it's in a weird way, sort of like writing a news story, which is a very, very different thing than what you're doing. But you do have this thing in the back of your mind where you know this baby is not working, and you're going to have to start again, but you just can't figure out how to get there. And it's the worst feeling.
A lot of times, if I act like I'm done with it, a few weeks it'll come to me.
Yeah,
but if I think, oh, I'm just going to sit here grinding on it. That same thing, a lot of times it just delays the openness required for the reality to come through.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our book doctors, and Daniel Woodrell is here in the house. His latest book, The Maid's Version, he's also written Winter's Bone and the book that became the Ang Lee film, Ride with the Devil. Steve Paul, in Sunday's paper, you called this book a Missouri classic. Why?
Well, it's set in Missouri, and it's a good read, and it really has a sense of, a cross-section of humanity. There are any number of books that you could maybe compare it to, maybe not, but it really stands out to me. And I've been an admirer of Daniel's work for a very long time. And one of the things I did in that book, what I did in that piece, was to go back to the beginning and really realize how consistent you were as a writer, and that really said something, I thought. And
there's such a spareness in your work. I know you've been told this many, many times, but that just resonates with me so much, because there is a mystique that goes with your writing. Help me here.
I think that it's also the language. I mean, I think the language, your ear for Missouri's talk, know, is really important and really kind of vivid. And I think that helps, and that gives it that sense of a classic quality to it, I think.
Does that spareness come to you naturally, or are you just constantly stripping and stripping and stripping as you go through a novel like this?
It's more instinctive now, more natural to me. Earlier on, Steve and I were both talking about Hemingway earlier. He was one of the first big influences on me on how to construct a page of prose, and that leanness and so forth, and a visual quality usually that that laid kind of the underpinning for almost everything I did have done since then in terms of prose style, trying to develop it. There are other influences that enter into that are a little more florid at times than Hemingway is, but he showed me how to build a paragraph.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the sense of place in the Ozarks, I'm just wondering these days to what extent newcomers would be welcome in the Ozarks and where you live, Daniel. Give us a sense of that place.
I think they're very welcome these days and have been for some time now in most sections. Most of the people I know were not born there. Most people I know socially are from somewhere else. I was at a party in Douglas County and way out in the boonies, and there were 50 people there. Only two of us had been born in Missouri, and there were three who'd been born in Africa. So,
is that right?
Yeah. So it's a lot. There is a much broader swath of people around there now than you might think from a distance.
Yeah. Well, in your last book, The Outlaw Album, you do reflect on certain characters who don't think much of newcomers.
Yeah.
But
there are always some people who resent it, partly because they'll pay more for land and other things, and you want to buy a farm down the road, and suddenly it costs a lot more than it did 5 years ago or last year that kind of thing. But I don't hear near as much about that as I did 20 years ago or 25 years ago.
You know, there is, if our listeners want to join in and call and have a question for Daniel Woodrell, obviously you're always welcome to do that. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @kcuruptodate. You know, there's always, Daniel, this violence in your books, this sort of back-to-nature mayhem that never seems to be too far away. What are you telling us about the Ozarks and the way people live there, the fact that rawness is just around the corner, it seems like?
I think that, especially with the characters I usually write about, they're in pretty tough circumstances, and their sense of self and pride is one of the few things they can enforce. That's why historically in the South, it was customary if you had a beef with someone from the aristocracy to just wait for them to ride by and then run through the woods. There are books written on that topic about the kind of resentful violence of the rural South and the mountain South. And I think those legends live on, and you still hear things once in a while, but it's almost always personal. If you're not known to the other person, you can probably walk right through them shooting each other. it's really it's not a place where you get crime by strangers upon you. If you have a problem, it'll be somebody you know.
And that happens.
Yeah, it does. I haven't had to experience too much of it, but I do know that, like with my mother and stuff, if somebody ever tried to mug her on the street, the main problem would be all the guys beating each other up to be the one to beat up the mugger. So,
yeah.
I mean, it just wouldn't happen. I think we've had one street crime in the last 20 years like that. So,
You used to live around here.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you live?
I lived on 75th or 76th in Quivira, and I lived in Overland Park at one time.
Now, why do I have a hard time picturing Daniel Woodrell living in Overland Park and 75th and Quivira?
Right.
That just doesn't seem like you.
My father went to night school all my most of my youth. He eventually graduated and became a low-level executive, and they promptly sent us to Kansas City. And he had to find a house in a hurry, and somebody told him, go out there and get one. And so there wasn't much. He didn't know Kansas City very well either, so when he bought the house. And it was it's kind of attractive now, the old place now, because the trees finally grew up. They were just these little saplings in red dirt out in the yard then. And I moved there at 15, and I left the week I turned 17 to go into the military.
And when you came out of the military, did you move south right away, or did you come back here?
No, I lived in Lenexa for a little while, and then I eventually went to Johnson County Community College, and that meant even though I had a GED from Guam in the Marines, but then that meant that KU had to give you a trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, without really knowing it, I cunningly got my way in there. It turned out to look cunning, but
yeah. When did you end up down in the Ozarks?
I started living there full time in the 80s, middle 80s.
Yeah. All right. Well, what's the next book after the Maids version? Where are you going?
I'm not sure. It'll almost certainly be in Missouri. There's something having to do with at least one third of it would be Kansas City related that I'm not sure if it'll fly yet, but I'm intrigued by it.
Mm-hmm. You're tinkering with it and monkeying with it and trying to figure it out right now.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I should point out that Daniel Woodrell will speak tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to get a ticket. That number, 913-384-3126. You know, I know you're asked this question a lot, too, but how has the success of Winter's Bone changed things for you? Because certainly that book puts you on a map in a way that perhaps the other books quite hadn't yet.
Oh, no, definitely. By a factor of several times.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't really notice it where I live, but when I get out and travel to the coast and to cities, I become aware that a lot of people have gradually come to the book from the movie, and it's spread the name widely. And even if they don't know my name, they'll know that name, Winter's Bone, and quite often anyway. And so it's made a big difference that way.
How have you handled that? How has it been for you? Is it all good, or is there some downside to it?
It's mostly all good. I mean, you do get more people who want you to find them somebody to make their movie to, and I actually didn't have anything to do with people getting the rights to Winter's Bone and making it, but it's basically been all very good.
Did you watch the filming of that movie? Were you on set at all for it?
No, it was only a 24-day shoot, and it happened to be at a time when I was ill and just couldn't go over.
A 24-day shoot for Winter's Bone?
Right.
No kidding.
$2 million. For the whole thing. So
and it made how much?
I think it did around 20, but and then DVDs and all that, I have no I don't know, but
Well, I appreciate all that, and boy, what an interesting experience that must have been. Were you happy with the movie the way it came out?
I was. You know, you always live in fear that it'll have the title and not much else,
but it didn't, though. That book clearly didn't.
The book was, both the movies I've had, the Ang Lee and this one, the book was definitely present in both of them. So,
I thought the Winter's Bone film was terrific. I thought the book was better. I just did. I just thought the book was, it resonated more somehow.
I can second that. I can second that. I think that was just a great book. I mean, a really fine book,
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's so good to have you here. Stick around a little bit. We're going to talk about some books coming up in the fall, and if you have some books that you've been reading right now you want to share with us, we'll have you chime in too. How's that?
Great.
Okay. Sure. Let's start with our list of books that you guys brought here. Grace and Steve Paul here are in the house. Mark Luce is joining us on the phone. Mark from the Barstow School. And Steve Paul, set us off here. What do you want to talk about this
morning? Well, I had no idea what we were going to be doing today, and I thought we could look ahead and talk about books that are coming out this fall because we're on the cusp of the season, and Daniel's book actually comes out today. I mean, the official
publication date
is today, and so we are there at the fall book season, which is the biggest of the year, and it looks like Grace has got some things to talk about. I can mention a few things. I'll start out by saying, I mean, it's going to be an exciting year for fiction. Big names and names we haven't heard from in a long time. We were talking earlier about Bob Chakotchis, who was a one-time Missouri writer, has a big novel coming out sometime soon, and Donna Tartt, who we haven't heard from for about 10 years, and Thomas Pynchon, Grace has plugged into that one, and Margaret Atwood has a brand new book that is kind of related to her Oryx and Crake, futuristic apocalypse kind of books. I will mention this. We'll have some coverage of this later this weekend, but this book has just come out. We will have not one but two biographies of Charlie Parker.
Yes, yes.
By
our very own Chuck Haddix, right?
By our very own Chuck Haddix, and one by the critic Stanley Crouch from New York, who's been working on Parker for a long time. It's really interesting, and our review this coming weekend does a nice job of declaring that these books work really well together. They're complementary, different styles, different facts here and there, and they really tell, for those of us who are interested in jazz and the Kansas City legacy, important books. Again, Chuck Haddix from Kansas City, his book called Bird, and Stanley Crouch's Kansas City Lightning.
What are you coming away from those books that maybe you hadn't really hit on before? I mean, the arc of Charlie Parker's life is pretty well known to a lot of us who pay much attention to jazz. What are you walking away from, perhaps, that maybe you hadn't quite fully grasped?
You know, there are moments in there, but Chuck does a nice job of exploring the influence of Buster Smith and the period at the Lake of the Ozarks.
Buster Smith being
a saxophone player from Texas who was very influential. He was kind of a mentor to Parker, early mentor to Parker. But there's one chapter when he was dealing with Parker. Parker worked really hard to be who he wanted to be, and he spent 6 months at the Lake of the Ozarks at a club down there, working really hard. And when he came back to Kansas City, some of the musicians here were just blown away by how much he had improved.
Wow!
And
wow.
Here he is; he's still just 17 years old, on the verge of going to New York and kind of making his career as a musician. Then there was also the sad, the sad part of it. On one of his trips to the Lake of the Ozarks, he's in a car accident and break some bones, and he is given some pain medication, which he never got off of.
Mm-hmm.
And do we learn anything really new about the, like you said, the arc of Charlie Parker? I'm not sure that we do. We certainly get a sense, a deeper sense of, the milieu and the
We were talking at the newspaper just a few weeks ago about the fact that Charlie Parker's birthday just came and went. Mm-hmm. And just a few years ago, that was becoming a celebration of some some note, prominence. And the BBC was showing up. Reporters from across the country were coming to the small cemetery where you and I would go out to on a Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. There'd be this very cool little celebration of Charlie Parker's birth. And that's sort of gone by the boards the last couple of years.
Yeah,
it's
gone a little underground maybe, or it's much smaller. There are little attempts at recognizing. There were just last week there were concerts here and there that were Parker tributes, but there wasn't in New York there was a big Charlie Parker festival.
I was gonna say,
and here we haven't quite gotten
round to the corner on that.
Well,
you and I need to work on that.
I know.
Let's just make an on-air
project.
We're going to try and make something happen next year. I'm going to get a phone call here from Mark Luce from the Barstow School, who can't be with us long today. But, Mark, you had a couple of suggestions, and I want to grab them before you've got a scoot here.
Oh, no, not a problem.
How are you, Mark?
I'm doing all right. It's good to hear you guys. I had a bit of a plumbing disaster last night.
It happens.
I really can't do laundry anymore, so I'm not sure what it's what I'm
so good news,
do.
Bad news.
Yeah.
But what I do know is that I recently reread Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick, the novel that they made, the fine film of Blade Runner, or actually three or four different director's cuts of Blade Runner from. And I have to say that although I rather enjoyed teaching it and talking about the nature of reality and what it means to be human and what it means to have empathy, is that Philip K. Dick is, I mean, I'm glad that I'm hidden away in my classroom, but Philip K. Dick's kind of a genre hack. I mean, I kind of hate to say it, but the dude's writing is just not that good. His characters are pretty flat. The language doesn't sing. In fact, the language feels like a 14-year-old driving a stick shift, just grinding in between chapters. And I, to be honest, you know, I hadn't read it for 6, 7, 8 years when I assigned it, and as I was reading it, I confided to a couple friends how difficult I found getting through it. Again, the ideas are great, and it's fascinating to talk about with high school sophomores, but the prose just not really doing it for me at all this time. Maybe it's age. I don't know.
It could be.
I'm just more persnickety on my in what I like.
What else has caught your eye lately, Mark?
Well, the thing that I really look forward to is I really look forward to reading Daniel's book. Absolutely loved the last one. Well, I really have loved all of them. And the other thing that I'm really looking forward to is the Pynchon book. There was a piece about him in New York Magazine.
And the Pynchon book is what, Mark?
It's the Pynchon book. I'm not gonna remember the name of it. I just know that Pynchon has a book that comes out, I think, this week or next week.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter to me. You know, he could write it. It could be a laundry list for
Bleeding Edge.
Yeah.
Say it again.
It's called Bleeding Edge.
You know, I didn't love Inherent Vice, which was the last novel. It's kind of a stoner detective novel.
I
don't have a sense of this. It sounds like what I've heard of this new one. It sounds like it's going to be at least better, or I might enjoy it better. But maybe it's just me.
I wonder I loved Crying of Lot 49. And all his books, in some ways, are detective stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Mason and Dixon, I think, is a detective story. So I look forward to his take on, you know, I think it's 90s and the internet. So I think that will be fun. And the thing is, you know, I like him. He's not as chilly as somebody like DeLillo. And he can still sort of write cultural critique, but with a wink and a smile on his face rather than, you know, an empty hotel, like a man brooding in an empty hotel room, like in a DeLillo novel.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I look forward.
I really look forward to that. And for Dan's book, Steve told me a little bit about it. Years ago, I went down there to interview Dan for a story for Kansas Alumni Magazine. And, he told me about this time when, this nightclub had basically been blown up, and you know, he told me a lot of stories that weekend, and it makes me very happy to see that was going to become a book.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
I have to try my lies out on somebody.
You're right. Well, I'm always a willing sucker. So
there you go. Well, Mark, I appreciate you taking a few minutes. I know you have some issues there to deal with at Barstow, but we sure appreciate you taking some time.
Again, thanks a lot, guys, and I hope to see you guys soon.
You bet. We'll see you soon. That's Mark Luce from the Barstow School. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors and all the fall releases. Daniel Woodrell will stay with us. Again, his new book, The Maid's Version. He appears tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to grab a ticket. That phone number, 913-384-3126. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's review of indie documentary and foreign films, you can find it and more information on all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with a recovering Missouri politician, and we'll hear the story of a runaway Colorado River slicing through the Grand Canyon and a terrific ride a bunch of folks went on. Well, this hour, we're talking with our book doctors today. Steve Paul, book editor for The Star. Grace Supp, a freelance writer and editor, is also here. Also with us in the studio this morning, we're honored to have Daniel Woodrell, the great Missouri author, his latest book, The Maid's Version. Steve Paul from The Star called it a Missouri classic in Sunday's paper. Again, he speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Daniel, you've seen, you know, so many changes with the publishing industry going back a number of years. How has it changed in for better or for worse, I guess, going forward here?
Well, one thing that happened is there's a proliferation of smaller publishing venues now. So a lot of books that would be considered too challenging or too unusual, or you're not well enough known by a major house, can now find some place that will take a chance on them.
That's a good thing.
And they can get distribution now for these books, which a long time ago that was always the problem with smaller presses. They were not able to get distribution for the books.
And they can get distribution now. Why, compared to a few years ago?
Just the market changed, and I guess
of Amazon.
Yeah, and it's worthwhile to carry them now.
You're nodding your head, Grace. You've seen the same thing.
Well, absolutely. I'm going to, if I may, point out a book that I worked on, White Girls by Hilton Alls. He's a New Yorker writer, and his first book came out from Farrar, Straus, Giroux. And this book, which, you know, because Steve Stegman told me I have to do full disclosure, I worked on in an editing capacity, is coming out from a small but very well-known press, McSweeney's.
Mm-hmm.
But that I think, is part of symptomatic of this big change from a very big, prestigious house to a much smaller house in the 14 years intervening. And 14 years ago, you wouldn't have done that. No one would leave Farrar, Straus, Giroux. That's as prestigious as you can get.
Well, not by choice. But
Well, he did do it by choice. Yeah. And because it's a very quirky, very challenging book, and he wanted to be able to write whatever he wanted to write without making it, you know, more respectable or changing the format. He wanted freedom, and so he went to McSweeney's.
But McSweeney's, I mean, it's an interesting house because it's kind of a cult brand in a certain way.
And well, it's so branded itself
very
well.
It certainly has a literary following. The whole Dave Eggers, who's a principal of McSweeney's, they have an automatic audience for almost everything they do.
Absolutely.
And Hilton Alls is not exactly an unknown writer either, given his association with The New Yorker. So
that's true, but he's not a household name.
Right.
He's not Malcolm Gladwell
but there
by
are,
any means.
Probably a dozen houses now devoted to street-level crime fiction and so forth that give a lot of people an early shot that they wouldn't have gotten 20 years ago probably.
So the notion of breaking in then, is it easier now, are you saying, than it was 20 years ago?
I think you may see publication more easily somewhere, and especially with the various kind of online publishing and so forth, too. Your short stories and others may not ever be in a book form, but they may be available that way.
Yeah,
I've been pretty well treated by the big houses, so I don't have any complaint on that. When I came in, my first editor was had been around a while, and she was willing to wait a few books to see how things went. I'm always hearing that that's rare.
It doesn't happen anymore.
Right. And I keep hearing that. I know there are a few editors around who insist on still doing business that way, but it may not be the general.
Well, you've had a couple of books turned into movies, Ride with the Devil and the book that became, Winter's Bone and the book that became Ride with the Devil. Are editors expecting you, that the books you put out now, to have a movie potential attached to them? And are they disappointed if it doesn't have that?
I never get that sense from my editor. She wants it to have quality. She has in her career edited Seamus Heaney and all kinds of other people. She's a language-oriented writer, and she just wants it to have that quality that moves her, and I never get shoved one way or another. I might do it to myself, but she doesn't do it to me.
Do you do that to yourself?
It's sometimes difficult not to wonder. I wonder if this has any chance to go that way.
But you have a very cinematic
style
in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly any of your books that I know of or that I can think of could easily be turned into movies. I mean, they're mm-hmm. Just in the characters and the action and the settings and that kind of thing.
I try not to actually think of that, but there are times when you'll wonder how someone else would view this. Mm-hmm. And
so how about the Maids version? What kind of potential do you think it has for the big screen?
So far, and it's been kicking around out there for a little while, they don't know how they would film it because of the lack of chronology and vast cast of characters. So mm-hmm. that's a case where and I'd be fine with me if it's not made. I'd certainly rather not have a movie made than have a bad one made.
yeah, I get that.
I don't know. I mean, the flashbacks, the nonlinear thing, I mean, that's in some ways that's pure – independent cinema.
You sort of wonder HBO, Showtime, somewhere like that is where they would take the time to do it that way.
Oh, so you're saying more of a miniseries, huh?
Maybe.
The whole thing. What else about the publishing industry has caught your eye in terms of the advances and all of that, the need for an agent, Daniel? What are you seeing on those fronts?
Well, you do need an agent, and that's been the case since I started. That was the first big hurdle was finding an agent.
And that's not easy any longer.
No, it wasn't easy then either, and it took longer than – it was more difficult than one might have thought. But one of the things about the writers I know, we never talk about money. So I don't know what other writers get. I never ask them, and they never offer. So I don't really know what other writers get that way. But I do know that there are a couple things that are big changes. When I first started, I wouldn't do publicity almost. Steve was my – I think you were my first interview ever. that was because I was in home turf, Kansas mm-hmm. City.
On that cusp between leaving Kansas City, and I'm still a little confused whether you had already moved or not. But
you can't do that anymore. I mean, maybe Cormac McCarthy can keep staying out of the
– Or Thomas Pynchon.
But you really have to be willing to go out and – do everything to help your book, just about.
And so. I see so many authors who come in here on the circuit working so hard on their own dime in many mm-hmm. cases. Even authors who are fairly well established who are just in the station wagon traveling the Midwest trying to get on public radio talk shows, trying to get the thing flogged a little
bit. Well, it's not just that. I mean, they have to be on Twitter. They have to have a blog. They have to do Instagram. I mean, it's never ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They do like it if you do. I don't do those things, but they would. I'd be very happy if I chose to do so.
So you don't.
Well,
do
some
Twitter?
Of that is the certainly some of that in the last 10, 15 years is the changing economics of book publishing. I mean, it used to be that publishers would have budgets for, touring authors and not everybody, but I mean, buy the ads in the review journals and that kind of thing. And because of the shrinkage of publishing budgets, a lot more authors are out there flogging it themselves, having to flog it.
Yeah, I just was thinking, you mentioned a little while ago that, Daniel, you never went in and saw Winter's Bone being filmed. It was a very short filming schedule. You never made it in there. Tell me about when you went in and you sat down somewhere and watched the film for the first time. What was sort of churning through your mind? How nervous were you when you sat down? Because you obviously didn't know what was going to come out in front of you. What was that like, watching that thing unfold in front of you?
I was nervous. They brought me to New York to have screening in a private screening room in Greenwich Village somewhere, and my agent went with me. It's like 10 in the morning or something. And
you're nervous.
I was. I really didn't know. And I knew that there had been budgetary issues and shooting schedule issues and that some things may not have ever gotten shot. And so I wasn't sure what I was going to see. As it kept going on, I kept looking at my agent. We kept looking at each other with slight nods. And then
that began to happen, 10, 15 minutes in?
Began to realize that it's you're not going to have some travesty done to your book. That's not happening. And it has a style and a pace that's different from the book, but it's its own thing, and it worked well enough. And when we walked out, I told her, she said, I love it. I said, I'm very happy with it. It's great. Now, on the plane home, I started saying, hey, wait, what about what about this scene? What about that scene? But I tried to go by my first response. When I walked out from the first screening, I said, I don't have anything to kick about this. I'm very happy with it.
So. I think Jennifer Lawrence was a choice for she portrayed that character beautifully.
Did you meet her?
I did meet her a couple times briefly, and she was just about the right. Almost exactly the right age.
But so when you first saw her up on the screen, were you thinking, did that click for you, or was it a moment of adaptation there a little bit for you?
Well, she's a little bit less fierce-looking in some regards than Rhea is in the book.
Yeah,
but
right.
That's sort of the extent of how good films happen, in that there were quite a few people mentioned before it was settled on Jennifer Lawrence there. During the couple of years it took to put the movie together, quite a few names crossed that were interested or whatever, and it ended up being Jennifer, who I don't know how long she was in the discussion, but lucky selection.
Lucky for everybody that she was the pick, absolutely. All right, again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our book doctors this morning, Steve Paul, Grace Saw. Daniel Woodrell is also here. He speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Renee Books and Fairway to grab a ticket, 913-384-3126. Grace, tell us about some things you're looking at here, and get yourself on the map here a little bit.
Okay. Let's see. I want to point out some books that are coming out that I'm really excited about.
Yes.
I feel like we've been talking a lot of guy books, and I just want to put a
set
couple.
That record straight there.
I want to say that I am really looking forward to the Nora Ephron book.
Mm.
I love her, and I think a lot of people know her as a movie writer and director, but I actually love her essays, and this is obviously a posthumous volume, but it's called The Most of Nora Ephron, and it's coming out just in time for my birthday, if anybody wants to. October 29th.
It's a series of essays, you're saying.
That's right.
Collection.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about that. I'm also looking forward to the new Donna Tartt book. We were talking before the show about writers who put out a book every decade or so, and she's one of those. This is only her third book.
And she's on your radar screen. Why?
Well, a lot of people, most people know her from the first book, The Secret History, which came out in 92, and I was at Knopf when it came out, so it made a big impression on us because that was our big title. But I just loved the book, and true to form, this is an almost 800-page book.
Wow.
And
is it also a thriller or a literary?
Yeah, I think it's about an explosion that happens in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Mm-hmm. Lots of
Katie's
explosions.
Katie's about halfway through it, right?
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Yeah, she's at Little Brown.
okay, Katie being
my wife.
Your wife, of course.
And Donna's at the same publisher I am.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
And is she liking it?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I'm really looking forward to that. So that's.
I love The Secret History. I mean, when it first came out, I mean, it was a big literary hype fest, but it was
really
a great read,
very gripping
and compelling. I frankly didn't. Her second book went by me. So
a lot of people felt that way about the second book. And when we were talking about books being turned into movies, I thought of The Secret History because I thought if The Secret History were published today, it would be a movie in 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
But 20 years ago was a different story, and there wasn't this fast conversion to movies that there is.
There
now.
Were some writers who won't sell the rights. So.
Mm. Yeah,
and she may have done well enough with the book; she didn't feel compelled.
Yeah, she certainly did well with that book.
Yeah.
And I have a writer that I like very much named Russell Shorto, and he wrote one of my favorite books called The Island at the Center of the World, which is a history of Manhattan. Have you read?
No, I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Really good. Mm-hmm. It's just fantastically written history. And he has a new book coming out also at the end of October called Amsterdam. It's a history of Amsterdam, and I'm really looking forward to that one.
Okay. Let's go grab some phone calls here. Cynthia from Overland Park. Cynthia, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I was curious, what exactly was the transition process of your book to your securing the opportunity for it to be turned into a movie?
How did Winter's Bone get there, get to the big screen?
They read it when it before it was published. There are scouts who scout manuscripts that are in the pipeline looking for things so they can get in early. And
they just get access to these manuscripts?
Yeah, I'm not sure how all that works. I've never worked in publishing, but
well,
I know
the
that...
The agent sends it to the scout.
So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we actually made the deal before publication. They read it and loved it, and they sent me her first film, which didn't make a lot of money, but I watched it, and I thought she made the best artistic choice at each point. And I said, I will take my chances
here. So when you say pipeline, are you saying that you had an ebook first, or
no? It was it goes from manuscript to galleys, and then there are advanced readers' copies, and they either had the loose leaf manuscript or they had one of the first advanced.
It was already at the publisher. The book was already at the publishing house.
It was already sold.
And then sold before publication.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Cynthia. Steve Paul, what else are you looking at here?
You know, I'm looking at a wide variety of things. I see Grace
you
has
always
a
are.
Food book on her. I'm going to talk briefly about a book that I've been reading, almost done with. It's called On the Noodle Road, and it's a really fun travel story by a woman. It's a true story. It's by a woman who's a writer, a cook. She's a Chinese-American. Her name's Jen Lin Liu. Or Liu Lin, sorry. And she is traveling from Beijing to Italy to write about noodle cultures from here to there. And she does a really fine job of spending time with people in remote Western China. She has some unusual experiences in Iran. Her husband is a character in this book, and there's a little bit of kind of relationship balancing as she travels, sometimes with him, sometimes without. It's a really nicely told journey with recipes,
and the title of that book again.
It's called On the Noodle Road.
It
explodes the myth that Marco Polo connected the Chinese to and brought pasta back to Italy. The noodle culture goes back much farther than that. She argues, and you know, not everybody cooks noodles all the way across China, but the people she finds in unusual places. There's a lot of good cultural observation in various small towns and villages and cities. And she spends a lot of time with women whose men are not the most admirable creatures. And anyway, it's got a lot of layers to it, and the food aspect of it is quite good. Yeah, Jen Liu Lin, On the Noodle Road.
Grace, back to you.
All right. Well, I'll do my food book, and again, per Stephen Steigman, I have to say that the author is a friend of mine, Kate Christensen, and she's a well-known novelist. This is her first book that's not a novel, and she's probably best known for, her most recent book, The Astral, won the Penn Faulkner Prize.
Hmm. Wow. But
she's written four or five novels. In the Drink is a very well-known one, The Great Man. And this one is a memoir. I'd say that it's probably closest to one of Ruth Reichel's books because it's her personal story interspersed with recipes. And it's a very, I'd say that it's for anyone who's an admirer of her book and of her novels. And she has a lot of fans out there. They would really like reading this. It's a lot to do with, she grew up in Berkeley, the daughter of a human rights lawyer. In a very countercultural family, but you know, we all have to separate from our childhoods, even ones that are countercultural. And so, it's all about her upbringing and the different ways that food has shaped her life.
And the title of that book again is
Blue Plate Special. by Kate Christensen.
And you mentioned Ruth Reichel, a former editor of Gourmet magazine.
That's
who,
right.
We were broadcasting live from my kitchen once upon a time at the end of the show, and we were someone was doing some fire on a creme brulee, and the smoke alarm went off. The end of the show. It was one of the great moments in broadcasting history. Yeah. Daniel, what are you reading these days? What's on your plate?
There are two books that I've really enjoyed lately. I think they both are probably already out a week or two. But one is Last Car Over Sagamore Bridge by Peter Orner, which is a bunch of shards of storytelling from various times and places that, to me, ends up having the feel of a novel, and I don't know exactly what they're calling it. And then a collection of stories by Irish guy Kevin Berry called Dark Lies the Island that I'm really enjoying.
Dark Lies the Island.
Yeah, he's really good.
Yeah, sounds great. Just a couple of minutes left, Steve. What else you got?
Another wacky novel from Carl Hiaasen. I don't know if you have ever read his Florida comic thrillers, but his latest one is called Bad Monkey. And it takes a while to figure out why it's called Bad Monkey, but there is indeed a monkey who becomes a part of this tale. Very convoluted. It's about a Florida sheriff down near Key West. A sort of a temporarily demoted police officer, or suspended police officer, who is now inspecting restaurants. He's on roach patrol, but he gets interested and involved in a murder investigation. The book opens when some folks are out on a fishing boat and somebody hooks an arm, a human arm, and that sets off this incredible story of whose arm was it, why was it where it was. There's medical fraud in this book. There's all sorts of couplings. There's Hiaasen has this great interest in the natural world, and there's real estate developers and house builders who are problematic, and all this stuff kind of collides throughout this book. It was really a fun read. It was a long read, and I didn't want to keep going, but I did. I wish it had been a little bit shorter.
And that book again is?
It's called Bad Monkey by
Bad
Carl Hiaasen. It's set in the Keys, the Bahamas. It's got some great comic stuff in it and wild over-the-top action.
Okay.
Hey, one of the best readings I've ever seen was Carl Hiaasen.
he's
a showman, and he's quick, and he's got a lot of stuff to say, and he can really he had the audience really going.
Well, speaking of readings, you can see Daniel Woodrell again tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Renovate Books and Fairway to grab a ticket, 913-384-3126. Daniel, such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks,
Grace, always good to have you, too.
Thanks for having
Steve
me.
Paul, as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Glad to have you, too. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with a recovering Missouri politician, plus a story of a runaway Colorado River slicing through the Grand Canyon. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.